My name's Albert Myers, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and people like you and conferences like this, and my pretty Al-Anon wife, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since September the 7th of 1973, and for that I'm eternally grateful. I bring you greetings from the Horizon Group in Dallas, Texas. We're so pleased and honored, both Sally and myself, to be here. And would like to thank Margaret and the committee so much for the invitation, and Pat and Ruth for the write-in yesterday. It's a little nostalgic for me, as some of you heard Sally this morning. She made her amends to Hot Springs. I did some of my best work here when I was drinking. And over in the corner, when I first came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first speaker that I ever heard, the first banquet speaker, was the legend from Olive Branch, Mississippi, Franklin W. And I went over to Franklin today and I said, "Franklin, you were the first banquet speaker I ever heard." And he said, "Son, you must have had an instant healing." It is such a privilege and an honor to be up here with people that I love and family. And Diane last night has touched my heart for quite a few years. We've been privileged and honored to speak together at several conferences. The good professor that from Miami that you'll hear tomorrow morning, the spiritual leader of the South. I want to tell you, his was one of the first tapes that I ever had. And I played that and played it and played it until I just wore it out. Because the humor that Ray put into the recovery was what I needed at the time. And now I'm just in gratitude. My life has been enriched with his friendship, and I'm very grateful for that. Wasn't the Al-Anon speaker this morning beautiful? What was her name? And when that may cost me. That was not a good move there. And when John was talking about those three banks, man, did I identify with that. Never did close any of those accounts, John. Just kept moving that paper around a little bit. And I love the way he handles deadlines. Now, I can understand. You know, we're wired funny. Did you ever listen to us really talk to each other? I was in a meeting not too long ago, and some guy came in and he said, "You know, I was really thinking of killing myself today." And the guy talking to him says, "Oh, hell, I was going to do that yesterday. I talked that over with my sponsor. We decided not to do that." And when John was up here today talking about not filing his taxes for 3 years, that was just as normal to me as anything, you know. The IRS should sit in on some of these meetings. One thing about it, we don't frighten easily, that's for sure. When Diane was talking last night about the inadequacy and the discomfort that she felt, you know, I could relate to that because I've always had that feeling of inadequacy, that feeling that I didn't fit, that I wasn't a part of. And as I look back from time to time, I think probably I was addicted to your approval long before I was ever addicted to alcohol. And when you're addicted to approval, you're very easy to manipulate. And I did a lot of things that I didn't want to do with people that I didn't want to be with. And I think people talked to me about my attitude long before they ever talked to me about my drinking. I've heard Joe talk about when he was a small boy, his dad used to say, "My God, you've got a hard head." Well, I could relate to that. I remember my dad saying to me, "My God, you're a stubborn kid." damn your hard-headed kid. Hell's fire, you're a hard-headed kid, you know? And it just seemed to me people talked to me like that long before they ever talked to me about drinking. I was raised by a father with a fourth grade education, a magnificent man who loved to hunt and fish and live off the land. And he was fun to be with because his philosophy was, if it isn't fun, chances are I won't be doing it for more than a week. And being an only child and dad's son, we went everywhere together. On the other hand, I was raised by a mother who cured all the illnesses of the world with a Vicks jar and a piece of flannel. Didn't make much difference what the illness was. Mother just started up here with the Vicks and went down to your ankles, you know. But the thing that I remember was that Mother could make hot toddies like nobody else in the world. And when you're an Iowa farm kid and those winters get cold and you have a cold and Mom says to you, I'm going to fix this toddy, you know, I remember that sugar water and that hot lemon and a couple fingers of Old Crow or Three Feathers or Four Roses or whatever it was, you know. And then Mother would say to me, this is going to make you feel better. And you know, it always did. I can remember almost right now. Yeah, you take a couple sips of that and it just kind of, you break out in a little cold sweat and the next thing you know, you just sound asleep. And you know, that kind of set me up. That's the sensation that I always had, the love for alcohol, is that it always made me feel better. And when reality got so painful for me, I could always use the alcohol. You know, I don't think sobriety has really altered my thinking all that much. I still get into just as much trouble almost in sobriety as I ever did when I was drinking. As a matter of fact, I've done some of my best alcoholic thinking in the 12th year of sobriety. And I've looked at business ventures that I thought were good and they weren't. And I've looked at certain personalities that I probably shouldn't have been running with, but I thought in time they'd see how wonderful I was, that they would see it my way. And I've had people around me who just love me enough to say, Albert, I don't think that's good for you. You may be going a little too fast. And up here, that alcoholic ego just kept saying over and over again, if they knew how good it was, they wouldn't talk to me like that. And you know, thank heavens for the old timers. Thank heavens for the people that go in front of us. The Franklins, if you will, because in my 12th year of sobriety, I was really in big trouble. And by chance, we happened to be up in Prince Albert. And if any of you know Cease, he's a marvelous man. And we were visiting one day and he said, talk to me a little bit, Albert, about what's going on in your life. And I told him that I was doing funny things, and I was thinking funny, and it shouldn't be that way in sobriety. And after a little while, C said to me, Albert, it isn't that you're doing anything wrong. It's that you're not doing some things at all. And I said, Cease, what does that mean? He said, well, Albert, when we first come into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, we're very serious about the program, and we're not very serious about the person. In a period of time, we start to get serious about the person, and we're not as serious about the program. He said, you remember how good you felt in the beginning? And I said, you bet. He said, well, I'd be willing to bet you're probably not reading your 24-hour book every day anymore. He said, I'd almost be willing to bet you're not reading pages 86 and 87 anymore. He said, I'll bet you don't even meditate like you used to. That I'd be willing to bet you don't pray as much as you used to. He said, I'd almost be willing to bet you don't even support your home group as much as you used to. And you know, as Cease kept going down the line, he just kept hitting me in the heart, you know, and everything he said had become so. And then he made the statement, he said, you know, Albert, sometimes we get so busy picking up the pieces that we drop the program. And so when Diane was talking last night, you know, I could relate. I could relate over and over again to the anxiety and fear that she was talking about. Because if I don't protect the thing that's protecting me, I'm in big trouble. And I have to be very, very careful. Because I think it's an AA comes of age, Dr. Tebow says, regardless of our veteran status in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, at any time the disease of alcoholism can return, and normally it's in the form of halitosis. I'm still tenacious and competitive, and I want it my way. You know, Sally talked this morning about dependency. Dependency is not my problem. Dominance is my problem. If I can't dominate it, I get indifferent about it. I want it my way or I won't do it at all. Sally still hates to send me to the grocery store for a quart of milk. Hates it. Not too long ago, I came back and she said, how much was the milk? I said, $60. It's almost impossible for me to get those carts up and down that aisle without putting stuff in there. It isn't that I need it, but I'm going to need it. I must have at least 6 tubes of super glue. I can't find it, but I. So sobriety hasn't altered me all that much. And you know, that's why I need you more tonight. You know, I need you more tonight than the first day I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because AA isn't much of a gamble if you don't have anything to lose. But as I stand here tonight, in your midst, with the love of my wife and my family and my friends, and everything that I have a great deal to lose. So I am in deep gratitude to be here this evening. You know, I listened to John talk about the service, and I was in that one, the WW2. And I went to boot camp in Great Lakes and wound up at a base called Camp Shoemaker. And I remember the first liberty that I was to have, three of us were just going to go 20 miles, I think, 20, 27 miles over to a little town called Hayward, California. No big deal. We're just going to hitchhike over Friday. Party Friday night, Saturday night, hitchhike back Sunday, and it would be okay. And we started out Friday, and I remember Saturday, and then I don't remember much, except that I got back to the base on Tuesday. I don't know how the other two got back, but I didn't get back until Tuesday. And I remember the shore patrolman came to the barracks and picked me up, and the next thing I knew, I was standing in front of this captain who seemed to have my portfolio of activities, and he was reading them. You know, your behavior in boot camp was relatively good, and your behavior on the base hasn't been all that bad. And as we talked back and forth, he said to me just out of nowhere, by chance, do you have a problem with drinking? And up here my mind said, God, you old fool. I mean, I'm 18 years old. I'm on a base with 95,000 other sailors. There's a war on. I'm about to be shipped out. I'm an Iowa farm kid. And if I could just get back to my mother and my father and my familiar surroundings, I wouldn't be afraid, and I wouldn't drink the way I drink. And that's what I thought. I was discharged from the service, got back to the University of Iowa in the fall of 1946, and like Sally described this morning, I took that $90 check that John talked about, and I found an escape for it in the pool halls and the taverns and the golf course. Because when I got back, somebody talked to me about some entrance examinations, just very simple things, communication skills, mathematical skills, and all of a sudden that insecurity hit me again. And I remember I went over to this tavern and I had a couple of drinks and it began to ease the reality of, well, it's not that big a deal. But you know, everything that bothered me and made me uncomfortable in the world of reality, I had to have a drink for. When you find something that takes away the pain, it's difficult not to use it. At least it was for me. One night in this Iowa tavern, I saw Sally, just by where Ruth is. And, you know, she was just the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. The most striking thing. And I remember talking to this Fidel brother of mine, and I said, Bob, do you happen to know that girl? And he said, well, that's Sally Sears from Des Moines. And I said, oh, that should be mine. You know how we think, that should be mine. And you know, part of the problem that I had was I knew that Sally was kind of a big gal on campus. Not big that way, but, you know. And she was the Theta Queen and this and that. And somehow I thought if I could capture the queen, that would make me a king. See, I operated a lot on the premise that if I got something good, you would know that I had something good for me. You know, it didn't have anything to do with love and affection because I didn't know how to function for the well-being of another person. I didn't know anything about love and affection until I got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I had to come to this program to find out that having a good relationship is not finding the right person, it's being the right person. My having a good love affair with Sally doesn't have anything to do with Sally. It has everything to do with my behavior. When my behavior is good, my love affair is good. And when my behavior is funny, my love affair is funny. And when my behavior is bad, my love affair is bad. And you know, that's what brought me to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, was my behavior reached such a stage that even I couldn't stand it anymore. I found out Sally's telephone number, and like she said, we alcoholics, once we get a hold of something, we're smooth and we're slick. And I went to work, and within 3 weeks, I cashed in all of my war bonds, bought a ring big enough to go over any finger, wasn't gambling, and I called Sally at the dorm and said, could you meet me out in front? And she said, why, sure. And I want to tell you, at 10:30, whatever night that was, I was so drunk I could hardly get the car parked on this parallel ledge. And Sally came out and got in the car, and I said to her, wouldn't it be wonderful if you could have me for the rest of your life? You know, that's the way it got started. We were two frightened kids. She said yes. We got married. And then that addiction to approval that I had to have as an individual, we needed as a couple. We were two young, frightened kids. You know, I'm still startled that God's most precious gift has turned over to rank amateurs. We didn't know anything about having children. We didn't have a manual on kids. We just thought you should have children as part of being accepted in society. And I don't know about now, but right after the war, you talked about having a lot of kids. I mean, 3 and 4 and 5 and 6. I remember we used to look at the names in the books there, and we'd pick out a half a dozen different names. And we didn't have any money, and on the weekends, we'd drive around the neighborhood trying to find a house that looked good so we could make our house look like that. And we found one house that had a red door and a brass kick plate, and I remember we went home and painted the door red and put on this brass kick plate. And a couple weeks later, we'd drive around and we'd find some shutters that looked good on your house. Then Sally and I'd go find some old antique shutters, and we'd paint them black and put them on our house. And then a couple weekends later, we'd drive around and look at your shrubbery. And then we'd go get what looked like your shrubbery and put it in front of our house, because Sally knew that when you drove in front of our house, you would nudge each other and say, boy, that's a good-looking house. Should be. Looks just like yours. Somehow we fell in the trap that if we looked good on the outside, you would think we looked good on the inside. And that's the way we started our marriage and our relationship and raising our family. And we really didn't know any better. Like Sally told you, I've been in sales, and we moved around the country a great deal, Kansas City and St. Louis. And I was working for a large corporation called Owens Corning Fiberglass. And I was in this corporate ladder and working my way up. And I had just received a nice promotion to go to New York. You know, Sally and I flew into New York. And I remember flying in. Our conversation was the same as it has always been, you know, before when we had a chance to move. This time we have a chance to start over. This time it'll be different. This time you won't overdraw the checking account. We'll have enough bedrooms, a big enough yard, close to the school, next to the church. You know, we kept looking for all of those tangible things that was going to bring it together. And we never saw the disease of alcoholism. You know, it's such a deceptive disease. You're dealing with a disease powerful enough to kill people that don't have it. You know, if you cripple the kids with the disease of alcoholism in the home, you can't be too startled when they limp in society. We almost killed our kids with the disease of alcoholism, yet I'm still growling at Chuck, 34 years old, wondering when is he ever going to stay out of jail? I didn't make it to the program till I was 46. And I forget sometimes when I look at the kids that they have this problem. Sally and I went back east, and she found this lovely home up in Westport, Connecticut for the family. And you know, I began to commute into New York, and Sally and the four children were at home up in Westport, Connecticut. And I remember one Friday evening I came home from New York, and Sally made some comment about the condition that I was in. And whenever Sally began to close in on me and I knew she was right and I couldn't stand it, I would always get the stinging sarcasm out. I love sarcasm because it didn't show. You know, I could hurt you with the sarcasm, but it didn't draw any blood. And I would go into my routine and I'd say something sarcastic to Sally that would just almost cripple her. And then she would always say to me, "Do you mean that?" And I would say to her, "Do I mean what?" And she would say, "What you just said." "What did I just say?" "Well, you know what you said." "No, I don't. Why don't you tell me what I just said?" And then Sally would say to me what she thought I said, and then I would really go into my routine, and I would say, "I did not use that tone of voice." "I did not say it like that. You took it all wrong." And if I could get Sally to talk long enough, she invariably would wind up saying, "Albert, I'm really sorry for misunderstanding." And I would say, "By God, you should be as hard as I work." You know, that's the kind of idiotic thing that we went through. And if you were to stop me on the street and say, "Albert, how are things in your life?" I would say, "Terrific. God, I'm working for this large corporation. I have this beautiful wife, these four children, this dog, this home up in Westport, Connecticut." And you know, on the surface, I meant that. Because based on the pressures of society, I did all the things that you told me to do. It should have added up. And somehow we were bleeding to death on the inside. We were just dying while we were trying to live. You know that feeling you don't know how to die and you don't know how to live? You just, all of a sudden you find yourself existing, you know, from day to day. And one other time I came home on a Friday evening. I had been in Texas and I had too much to drink and leased a car and drove up to Westport. And as I came through the back door, Sally didn't even make any conversation. She just said, "I can't live like this anymore. I'd rather be dead. It's just too painful trying to live with you. I never know what condition you're going to be in, whether you're going to come home or not come home, if you're going to be sober, if you're going to be drunk, what condition you're going to be in." And I remember saying to her just briefly, "Hey, look, I've worked hard all week long. It's Friday night. Go to bed, and in the morning we'll talk about it." And on a Saturday morning in Westport, Connecticut, I remember Sally picking up a razor blade on top of the dresser and going to the bathroom and saying, "I would rather be dead." And I began to yell, like, you know, "God, Sal, don't do that. Nobody ever wins by dying. Does my drinking bother you that much? Just tell me I won't drink anymore. God, just don't do that." And you know, those four children that Sally talked about this morning were standing right behind me while I'm doing all of this screaming, "Please don't kill yourself. I'll stop drinking." You know, I've been privileged to work with the Alateens in this program. And the Alateens tell me there's a sound to the disease of alcoholism. I was working with a 15-year-old kid. He got in my car one evening, and I said to him, I said, "Mike, how are things at your house?" And he said, "They sound okay." And I said, "What do you mean they sound okay?" He said, "Mr. Myers, I can put one foot in the house and determine the condition of the home immediately by the sound." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No, I can put one foot in there. There's either too much noise, or there's no noise at all, or there's sarcasm, or yelling, or profanity, or flesh hitting flesh, or furniture hitting the wall." He said, "You know, depending upon the sound that I hear, that's my defense." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No, if I hear the wrong sound, I go to my room and turn up the stereo. Or I go to the phone and call somebody that can relate to what I'm about to say. Or if the pain is too great, they do what most of them do. They just back out on the street because there's less pain out there than there is in the home." He said to me one time, he said, "You know, Mr. Myers, if the sound of your house is the same today as it was a year ago, chances are you're not growing." You know, and Sally and I started thinking about that. We started to think about the sounds that were in our marriage and our relationship that caused a lot of pain. I'll give you one that's very innocent, very well-meaning. On Friday night in sobriety, I would get home and I would say to Sally, "Let's go out for dinner." She'd say, "Terrific." We would get in the front seat of the car and start down the street, and I would say to her, "Where would you like to go for dinner?" You know what's coming, don't you? And she would say to me, "I don't care." And I would say to her, "Let's go to Vincent's and get some fish." And she says, "I don't feel like fish." "So let's go over the split rail and get some barbecue." "I don't feel like barbecue." Now, I want to tell you, within a few minutes, it was just, "Well, damn it, then let's go home." Now, I don't know how many times we've done that in sobriety until that young man mentioned to us, you know, look out for the sound. I'll tell you a very easy one. I used to say to Sally, "Bill Sears shouldn't get anybody into any trouble. Happens to be her brother." And every time I say Bill Sears, she defends him and I tear him down. And within 10 minutes, I'm going out the front door saying, "And I still think he's the dumbest thing I ever met." And one night early in my sobriety, I said Bill Sears, and we started right on cue. And I remember going out the front door saying, "And he's still the dumbest thing I ever met." I got in my car, and I remember in the big book it says, "Resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything." And I'm driving down Central Expressway. I said, "Man, I better get to my sponsor's house." And I remember I drove over, and I started to talk to him, and I said, "Let me tell you, every time I say this to Sally, we have this fight." And he listened for a while very patiently, and pretty soon he said to me, "Didn't you have this drinking problem?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "What did you do about that?" I said, "I don't drink anymore." He said, "Well, it would seem to me I wouldn't say Bill Sears." Folks, that only took 31 years. It's amazing. You know, Sally and I have had a chance to listen to the sound in our relationship, and the young people in this program are something special. I managed to get my arms around Sally that morning, and we took her to a psychiatrist. Now, I don't know how we figured that out. Somehow we figured that if we could get her fixed, I wouldn't drink so much. I don't know how we do that. But I remember we took her to the psychiatrist, and we agreed that whatever he said, we would do. And I think after a month's time, he suggested that we go back to Iowa because we're Iowa farm kids and we're out of our element and we're back in New England. And if we got around family, we would be okay. And you know, we put that almost down on paper, just about like the blueprints you would make if you wanted to build a house. And as we headed back for Iowa, we looked at that thing several times and it should have worked. The only thing that we never put in there was the disease of alcoholism. We just never saw it. Sally never called me an alcoholic. It's such a deceptive thing. By the time it deceives you, and by the time you deny it, you can look right at it and say, that's not the problem. Like John said, I used to think money was my problem. My creditors never called and said, "Hey, you're drinking too much." They called and said, "Hey, send money, pal, you know." Isn't that right, John? Nobody ever told, not my creditors. And, you know, it just almost blew my mind. We got back to Iowa City, and I became pretty much of a periodic drunk. It isn't that I didn't drink every day, but it just seemed that every once in a while when the temperature was right and somebody would say, "Let's go to Chicago or Las Vegas," I'd say, "Terrific." And as Sally indicated, one day I did that 3 days too many. And when I got back home, they were in my living room. I call them they because I don't know where they come from. But, you know, they always show up when you need them the least. And they were saying things like, "You need to go to the alcohol and psychiatric clinic at the University of Iowa." And I was beginning to say funny things like, "Okay." And pretty soon the evidence gets to be so tangible that you just can't duck anymore. And I think it's Clancy that says, when they begin and say, "This is for your own good," you know you're in big trouble. And that's the way they were talking that morning. And I remember on a Monday morning, I sat across the desk from this fellow at the University of Iowa in the Alcohol and Psychiatric Center. And we had known John socially. And he was just talking to me one-on-one and said, "Albert, it just seems to me that when you drink anymore, you hurt an awful lot of people." And I said, "Yes, John, I do." And he said, "It seems to me when you drink anymore, you get into all kinds of trouble." And I said, "That's so." He said, "Let me tell you a little something about alcohol." I said, "Okay." He said, "There are people that are allergic to strawberries. When they eat them, they break out in a rash. Your problem is when you get an ounce of alcohol in you, you have hives of the brain." I remember saying to John one-on-one, "My God, John, I'm allergic to alcohol." And he said, "That's correct. I suggest that you talk to a member of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and that you go to an AA meeting." And on a Friday afternoon, a very well-meaning, loving man who is now dead took 3 hours of his valuable time and told me of all the things that had happened to him, the guilt and the remorse and the shame and the degradation and the DWIs and the bankruptcies. And, you know, as he kept going through this story, this hadn't happened to me. And I thought, my God, it's a terrible story. I went home that afternoon and I told Sally, I said, "God, if I ever get that bad, I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous. Or if I get as bad as your father, I'll join Alcoholics Anonymous." You know, just something about Sally's dad. Sally and I knew about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Her father came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1952 and had 25 years of continuous sobriety before he passed away some 10 years ago. So Sally and I knew what Alcoholics Anonymous would do for the family. When I finally made it in 1973, I said to Dad, I said, "My God, Dad, why didn't you say something to me about my drinking? Geez, I took everything that you loved the most in this world. I took your daughter, and I took your love, and I took your money, and I took your booze, and I just stripped you of everything that I could take, and you never once said anything to me about my drinking." And this magnificent man with these just almost piercing blue eyes just quietly said, "You would have resented it so much coming from me that it would have ruined the opportunity for the right person to reach you." He said, "God created us all different, so we need each other. If he made us all the same, one of us wouldn't be necessary. And more than that, he's gifted each one of us with the ability to touch one other human being that nobody else can touch. And I'm almost willing to bet that everybody is here tonight because one person had the ability to reach in and touch you deeper than all the rest." Sally told you she wasn't silent. I want to tell you, for 26 years, she was vocal. She took her best shot. And she had some other people take their best shot. And one morning in a halfway house in Shreveport, Louisiana, a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor said to me, "You don't have to hurt anymore if you don't want to hurt anymore," and I haven't had a drink since. Don't you know Sally went crazy for the first 24 hours trying to figure out what he said? I started to drink again, and they showed up and they said, "We're going to take your house and we're going to sell it. We're going to keep the equity. We'll give you some basic furniture to live with, and we're going to auction that off." And as Sally and I were standing on the lawn with the house gone and the furniture being auctioned off and the four kids, we never saw the disease of alcoholism. The kids would get to be 18, they'd graduate from high school and supposedly would go off to college. They just never came back. We have four children. We have a daughter, Roxy, who's 36, and a guy, 34, and one 32, and one 27. I remember my daughter writing me a letter one time saying, "You'll always be my father, but my love for you will never be the same." And I remember I read that letter over and over again thinking, what have I done that's so bad? Why would she say that to me? God, certainly that can be mended some way. And the oldest son, who hit the campus in the late 60s and when the rebellious things were going on, got into drugs and sold and trafficked and jailed. And, you know, I just couldn't figure out what was going on. And the middle son just backed quietly away. It just seemed like one morning I went to the breakfast table and Tom was gone. And I just could never figure out where they went. And John, who was so small that he just couldn't get away from the disease of alcoholism. Just couldn't. The other three left. I used a friend to get a job in Shreveport, Louisiana. And Sally and I, in 1972, moved to Shreveport. Sally, myself, and John. And if you were here this morning to hear Sally talk about that year, it was just one of existence. I just got up in the morning and started to drink and tried to figure out how to get through the day, find a place to sleep that night, and start again the next morning. And one night, I guess it was down near Shreve Square, I looked in my rearview mirror and I saw these red lights going around and knew that some Caddo Parish police deputies would like to get me off the street. And I remember thinking, I'll be very put together, very clever alcoholic, and I'll pull this car over to the side very gently and I'll get my driver's license out in a hurry and be ready for them. And I finally got the car stopped and these two Caddo Parish police deputies came around to the side of the car and I rolled down the window and they said, could we have your driver's license? And I said, sure. I just handed it to them out the window. And I made a terrible mistake. I rolled up the window and drove off. As Ray would say, that was a tactical error. God, they got upset about that. They really got mad. I remember the second time they got the car stopped, there wasn't any dialogue. They just, you know, took me from the car and draped me over the hood, and I remember the handcuffs going up the back, and my alcoholic mind is saying, God, I hope nobody's watching this. You know, cars are just going... And we get down to the jail on Texas Avenue, and I remember saying, hi, gang, how are you? You know how you are. You're just walking in there, doing the fingerprints, and you're waving at everybody. Hope you're having a good time. And one of them said, we have to put you in a cell. I said, terrific, you know. And, you know, a strange thing happened when they shoved me into this cell. It was like head first, and as I turned around, those bars were coming together, and then that sound that God created for us when that metal hit. And for just one second, I saw myself on top of the glass building in New York to the jail cell in Shreveport, Louisiana, and I thought, damn, I got problems. And the man said, you could make a call. And I remember when he said that, it was almost a shock because I didn't have anybody to call. People that loved me just said, don't call anymore. We don't care. And so being a good salesman, I called a good customer, and you didn't have anybody else to call, you know. And he came down and got me out of jail. And I remember getting in the front seat of Frank's car, and I said, Frank, let's go get a six-pack, and we'll straighten this out. And Frank said, no, why don't you spend the night at my house, and in the morning we'll try to figure out what to do with you. And you know, when he said, in the morning we'll try to figure out what to do with you, that kind of hit me in the same dimension as my daughter saying, you'll always be my love. You'll always be my father, but my love for you will never be the same. And I sensed something was wrong, but I couldn't get it together. And I remember I stayed at Frank's house that night, and I watched the big clock in the kitchen, and it got to be exactly 6 o'clock, and I called this Episcopal priest down at Holy Cross Church in Shreveport, and I said, Father Paul, this is Albert, and I'm in big trouble. He said, can you get down to the church? And I said, yes. And I got down there, and we began to talk a little bit. And he said, Albert, I'd like for you to go to this halfway house. It's called the Bridge House down on Stoner Avenue. And he said, I think there's a retired electrical contractor down there that you can relate to. And up here I'm thinking, God, who's he talking to? I mean, I'm kind of a high-class guy. And I had big jobs and awards and recognition. He's talking halfway houses and a 74-year-old retired electrical contractor that I can relate to. But my sponsor says, some of us get here because we see the light. Others get here because they feel the heat. And I want to tell you, that morning the heat was on and I was saying funny things like, okay. At 10:30 on a Friday morning, I walked into this halfway house, and these three, four magnificent men were there, a couple old railroad guys, Rich, Dick H., Bill Smith, who's now dead. And they sat me down at the end of the table, about where John is, and one of them said to me, when did you have your last drink? And I just remember this volcanic thing starting to Oh, God, I had my last drink last night, and I got these $1,200 worth of hot checks, and the house is gone, the furniture's gone, they want to pick up the car, Sally wants to leave, three of the four kids are gone, and one of them turned to the other one and said, geez, he sure sounds like one of us. One of them said, would you do anything to get sober? I said, I'll do anything. And I think it was old Rich said, would you go to 7 meetings in a row? 7 meetings in a row? 50 miles in the rain to get a drink, maybe, but 7 meetings in a row? God, and I looked around, and there those dumb slogans were on the wall. I'd seen those in Sally's dad's house. Man, these guys were talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started to back up in this old contractor, so I was about to jump out of the boat, and he put his arm around me and said, Albert, we need to go over to Shumpert Hospital. He said, I've got a friend over there, and I want you to meet Sister Germaine. And I said, well, okay. We got in the front seat of his car, and on the way over to Shumpert, this is what he said to me. He said, you know, Albert, I never did quit drinking. And that's all he said. Didn't say any more, didn't say any less. And I started thinking about that. I said, man, that's fantastic. I mean, the priest was right. I can relate to this guy. I mean, I don't know how he's doing it, but I like the cure that he's talking about. And we went over to Shumpert, and we visited with his friend up on the 5th floor, as I recall. And on the way back to the halfway house, he set the hook one more time. He said, you know, Albert, I never did quit drinking. Matter of fact, I may have a drink tomorrow. I said, Bill, how long have you been doing that? He said, what's that, Albert? I said, that not quit drinking. He said, 27 years, but I may have a drink tomorrow. Now, he said to me, Albert, you know, nobody ever took my right to drink away from me. I don't know what I thought you were going to take away from me. You know, we alcoholics have got a hold of this rock, and we're going to the bottom of the lake. Everybody around us is saying, let go of the rock. And we're saying, hell no. Yeah. Man. I said, but Bill, you're going to take away my freedom. He said, your freedom? I said, let's talk about that a little bit. I said, I've got this dog that I put out in the backyard every day. I said, it's fenced in. The dog gets out there and he plays and he barks at the birds and he laps up the sunshine. There's plenty of food. At night I come home and I pick it up and I love it and I put it in the house. He said, now I could let that dog be perfectly free. Open up the back gate, it would get out, maybe get run over by a truck. Picked up by somebody that doesn't love it nearly as much as I do. Go without food and possibly starve. He said, it seems to me, of the two freedoms, I'd rather be the dog on the inside of the fence. He said, you can be as big and as free as you want in the fellowship of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as long as you stay on the inside of the principles of the program. And I said, but Bill, God, I'm a salesman. And I gotta go back out there and earn a living, and they're still out there. And what if they ask me if I want to have a drink? He said, you want to know what to tell them if they ask you to have a drink? I said, God, yes. He said, tell them you can't drink that stuff. It gets you drunk. I said, is that it? He said, that's it. He said, you do understand that when they drink it, it gets them drunk. I said, I never really thought about it. Now, I want to tell you, like everything else in the beginning, I thought that would never work. We're 90 days in the program. I have a new job. Sally and I over in Dallas. An ex-Dallas Cowboy football player came to my office to sell some media. We went to a place called the Hungry Hunter. And we went right up to the bar, and Dave said to me, Albert, would you like to have a drink? I said, oh, God, Dave, I can't drink that stuff. It gets me drunk. He said, oh, geez, don't drink it. I said, okay, I won't. I think it's Elsa C. that says, we wouldn't worry nearly so much about what people thought about us if we realized how little they didn't. This old man said, "You will come to the halfway house at 10:30 every morning." And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "This is going to be a relatively easy program. You just don't drink. We're going to change every other area of your life." I said, "Yes, sir." I said, "Bill, I'm going to admit my life is unmanageable. What are you going to do with it?" He said, "We're going to turn it over to a bunch of people that can't manage theirs." Now, when you're new in the program, things like that just don't make any sense. He said, "You're not going to travel anymore." I said, "What am I going to do?" He said, "You're going to sell used cars." I said, "I never sold used cars." He said, "You're going to start." I said, "Yes, sponsor." And I sold used cars for 2 months, and every day Bill would come by, and he'd roll down the window. He said, "You all right, Albert?" I said, "You bet." He'd say, "Okay." You hear what I said? He came by to see me every day. He took me to 7 meetings in a row. You know how upset I get sometimes when I see the new ones that are just crying out to get some help, and we say to them, "Well, go to 90 meetings in 90 days. I got something to do tonight, but if you need me, give me a call." That's not the way I came into the program. I'm telling you, these people pick me up on a daily basis. Bill said to me, "Hey, I want you to get a sponsor that you can relate to." He said, "There's a fellow that sells for RCA. He travels on the road and he stays sober." I said, "You got to be kidding. That's not possible." I said, "What's his name?" He said, "Hoss Ross." You ever notice who we turn our life over to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous? I want to tell you, I looked up Hoss Ross. I was at the Highland Club and on a Thursday night, and Hoss came in, about 6'3", 150 pounds, and he dressed in one color. All red, all blue, all green, what have you, you know. But my sponsor said I should have him. And I went over and I said to Hoss, "Hoss, you travel on the road?" He said, "I sure do, son." I said, "You stay sober?" He said, "Yeah." I said, "Hoss, would you be my sponsor?" He said, "Son, I would be honored." "You have Big Book?" I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Hey." And I remember he wrote in front of my Big Book. And we went over and signed one of those cards. And I want to tell you, Hoss called me every day. He'd call and say, "What are you doing, son?" I'd say, "Nothing." He'd say, "I'll be right over." And God, after about 2 weeks of that, I'm going crazy. And I told Sally, I said, "Oh, God, I think I've made a mistake. I can't shake this turkey." You know. Man. I remember one day he called and he said, "What are you doing, son?" I said, "Hoss, I'm busy tonight." He said, "Good, I'll do it with you." Just didn't make any difference. He came by one night and said, "Get in the car." I said, "Where are we going?" He said, "Texarkana." I said, "What the hell are we going to do up there?" He said, "You're going to talk." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "2 minutes. Stand up, give him your name, and sit down." You know, that's the way I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I want to tell you, on December the 13th of 1973, Sally and I went to Dallas, Texas, and didn't know a soul. We had each other, and we weren't too crazy about that. And I was driving a car that was co-signed by my sponsor, going to a job that was arranged by my sponsor, with money in my pocket to buy groceries from my sponsor, because finances have always been a problem for me. And I was fortunate enough to have somebody help me reconstruct that area of my life. You know, as I stand here tonight, fortunate enough to have anything that I have, the clothes that I wear, the money in my pocket, the car that I drive, the job that I have, came from exactly the same source as my sobriety. And there are many times that a man needs a $5 bill a hell of a lot more than he needs 10 minutes of my wisdom. And I have to judge that correctly sometimes. It says that in the Big Book, right, Joe? Hey, we're to help them, not to let them lean on. But there are some of us that need that kind of help to reconstruct our life. The youngest son hated me so much that he kept a loaded shotgun in the bedroom when I first came into the program. And I remember one time we had went into a psychiatrist's office that was recommended by the school, and we were in a little 10-by-10 room, and we hit each other with pillows, an old-fashioned pillow fight, trying to get the hostility and the anger out so we wouldn't kill each other. And he couldn't stand that. He had to go back to Shreveport and live with a family for 6 months while Sally and I got our feet on the ground. And at the end of 6 months, he came back and started to live with us. A couple of years into the program, Sally and I were out looking at houses one weekend. That's what alcoholics do when they don't have any money. They look at houses. or big cars. You know, you've got to start those dreams somewhere. And I remember on a Sunday night, I called old Bill in Shreveport. I said, "Bill, you'll never guess what we were doing today." He said, "What's that, Albert?" I said, "We were looking at houses." He said, "Tell me a little bit about that." And I talked to him for a little while, and all of a sudden, Bill said to me, "Would you like to buy that house?" I said, "Well, sure." But I said, "Bill, that lady said it's $50,000. 5% down, 8.75% interest, 30-year loan." I said, "I can't qualify for any of that." He said, "You haven't forgotten about honesty yet, have you?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, write a letter." I said, "To who?" He said, "The loan committee that lady is talking about." Did you ever notice how we alcoholics are scared to death of losing something we don't own anyway? I've been scared to death all my life. I can't get what I know I can't qualify for. It was just crazy. And Bill said, "I'll tell you what you do. You write this letter and you put down there, you work for this company. This is your area of responsibility. This is what you make, and you're a very active member of the Alpha Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Dallas, Texas. You write down there, Sally works for this group of doctors. This is her area of responsibility. This is what she makes. She's a very active member of the Al-Anon Family Group, Alpha of Dallas, Texas." And you know, Sally and I wrote that letter just like my sponsor told me to. And on a Monday morning, we drove up in front of the small savings and loan, and we got very quiet in the front seat of the car, and Sally and I held hands and said, "God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always." And there was a quietness in the front seat of the car, and a strength that Sally and I hadn't felt before. And there was a sensation of whatever happens is okay. And I remember we went into this little loan officer, and we started to fill out this questionnaire that all alcoholics hate, because the first question is, if you have lived there for less than 1 year, list below. And alcoholics put C attached. We've moved around a lot. I love Clancy's description of an alcoholic resume. It's got big holes in it that say self-employed. We just can't get it all covered up. Now, we got down to credit, and I said to the man, "We don't have any money, and we don't have any credit." And if you want to see a loan officer's face look very strange, I mean, but I wanted to say, but my sponsor said, "Give you this letter." But what I said is, "Take this letter and give it to the loan committee, and then you decide whether Sally and I should be a part of your community or not." And I want to tell you, Sally and I walked out that morning, and it was okay, whatever happened. And I want to say within a month's time, they called and said, "Come get you $50,000. And we had an AA home. And people have come to me, and I've been privileged to sponsor a lot of people that say, "Albert, I can't get it started. I can't get any credit. I can't buy a car. I can't get a house. I want to buy some land." And I say to them, "Write a letter." And their reaction is always the same: "It'll never work." And I say, "Well, do it anyway." And then it's just a short period of time that Sally and I will get a call, and they'll say, "You'll never guess what happened." And I'll say, "What's that?" And they'll say, "We got our house, we got our boat, we got our car." And you know, that's all because an old-timer in the program said to me, "You got to be rigorously honest. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path." You know, those who cannot or will not are those who can't completely get honest with themselves and this program. And it's still a difficult thing for me today to get completely honest. About 6-7 years ago, Sally and I were privileged to chair a meeting one night, and a man came in, and you could just see by the color of his face that he was in big trouble. And Sally, out of courtesy, said, "Is there anything anybody would like to talk about tonight?" And boy, this guy just jumped right straight up in the air. "I'd like to talk about it." He said, "I just got out of this treatment center. I got this crazy wife and 4 kids, and if I could just," you know, for about an hour, we tried to get a net over him, just get him calmed down. You know, at the end of the meeting, I went over and I said, "Hey, my name's Albert." And he said, "My name's Jim." I said, "Jim, what do you do?" And he said, "I'm the regional manager for Owens Corning Fiberglass." You know, I became his sponsor, and we became good friends, About 5 years ago, he said, "Why don't you come back to work for Owens Corning Fiberglass?" And I said, "Oh, God, Jim." I said, up there in my folder, there's a little card that says, "Don't ever, don't ever let this gorilla back." And And he said, no, we've changed our position on that. We have a very active employees assistance program, and of the 24,000 employees that we have, over 1,900 of them are in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said to me, why don't you write a letter? And I did. I knew who to write to, and I wrote this letter, and I said, dear God, Jim and I are talking about this, and if the possibility would present itself, it would just be more than I would pray for. In a short period of time, they wrote back and said, please send a resume. And I knew they had one, so I just gave them an AA resume. You know, September 6th, driving while intoxicated, jail, Shreveport Jail. Fired from last job, alcoholic performance, sold used cars, 2 months. I just put it all down there, and I shot it back up to Toledo, and sure enough, just within a short period of time, they said, could you come up for interviews? And I remember I got on the plane, and I flew up to Toledo, and the very first, I was to have 5 interviews this Monday, and I remember the very first one was kind of the professional corporate interviewer. And I was to sit down and answer these questions, and as I sat down, I noticed this kind of timid smile on his face, and he said, you know, he said, I really can't ask you these questions, but he said, I've been dying to meet you. He said, of all the resumes in Owens Corning Fiberglass, I've never seen one where a guy starts out in jail. You know, an interesting thing happened that morning. The one thing that had plagued me all of my life, fear, was gone. I knew who I was, and I knew what I was. And he knew who I was and what I was. And it was okay. Now, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says I'm a child of God, and I don't have to crawl before anybody anymore. And it was nice to be free of that. I wasn't hiding from anybody. And the fifth interview that day was a man that had been my branch manager in Kansas City. And the interview went like this. He said, how's Sally and the kids? I said, terrific. How's Marion and your kids? He said, fantastic. You ready to come back to work? And I said, yeah, you bet. And they bridged 20-some years and took me back to work for Owens Corning Fiberglass. I'll be eternally grateful for that experience. A little over 4 years ago, I had a heart attack. I was playing racquetball, and I had a heart attack and didn't know it. I didn't have any of the customary pain or pressure that everybody talks about. All I had was just a little pull under my right shoulder. And the following day, I went to work, and following evening, Sally and I went out for dinner. And as the evening progressed, it began to nag a little more. And I said to Sally, why don't you run me down to Presbyterian Hospital? We'll just get it checked out to make sure. And as we were down there, all of a sudden this guy said, you know, you're going to feel better with these hoses up your nose and this IV in your arm. And I had a heart attack and closed the whole right coronary area down. And I went directly from the emergency ward up to an intensive care unit. And if you know anything about intensive care, they're very strict and very rigid. And there's signs on the wall, family only, 2 people only, a limit visit to 2 minutes. And Sally and one of the sons had just left, and I'm in the oxygen and wired for sound. And as they left and I was kind of coming in and out, I came to, and all of a sudden this beautiful black person that I sponsor was standing at the end of my bed. And I said to Bob, I said, Bob, how the hell did you get in here? He said, I told him I was family. I said, what else did you tell him? He said, I told him you were my father. We really are family. You know, I tell you what I hide from the rest of the world. I'm so grateful to have a place to come ventilate my disease because you're the only people that understand. I got out of the hospital and I was in a cardiovascular class and I had a second heart attack and didn't know it. I went in for a routine physical and done some damage to the front of my heart. So they sent me over for an angiogram, and the cardiologist was working on me, and he said, we're going to have to give you this angiogram because you can't seem to monitor your disease. And I said, yeah, I've had that problem once before. And And after the examination, they said, hey, you're going to have a triple bypass. And, you know, you as an alcoholic, you want to negotiate just a little bit. But the finality of it was, I said, what's the alternative? And they said, you'll die. And I said, oh, okay, I understand that. You know, I don't advocate open-heart surgery for an in-depth third step, but I will tell you this. The night before open-heart surgery, you will take an in-depth third step. There is awareness that you are not running anything. And, you know, it was surprising, the third step prayer and the third step and the seventh step prayer. And the thing that startled Sally and I is that you surrounded us so rapidly, you know, with your cards and your letters and your loves and your big books and grapevines and telegrams and flowers. And it was just amazing. You know, nurses just go crazy because they come in and say, Are you somebody special? And they just don't understand. And the experience that we had is that, you know, Sally and I know that there isn't anything that can ever happen in our life that we can't get through with you and your help. It was just an incredible experience. It's nice to stand here with a rebuilt engine and have another 100,000 miles to go, I guess, you know. A couple years ago, the daughter called me, and she was having problems with her marriage and her relationship, and said, Dad, could I come to Texas and bring the boys? And I said, sure, Roxy, when are you coming? And she kind of told me, and I said, you may want to pick another weekend because Mother is at Oklahoma going to a woman-to-woman or heart-to-heart or whatever. And she said, no, she said, I think I'd like to come down and be with you. And I said, boy, that's terrific. So Roxy and the two grandsons flew down, and I'm a father who is still plagued with guilt. I still have that thing that I want to give you a materialistic gift to let you know that I really am sorry and that I really care. And Roxy knows that, and she has to be careful when we go shopping, because if she points at it, I'll probably try and get it for her. But, you know, we were walking around North Park Mall, and we were shopping, and I said to Roxy, hey, I saw in this morning's paper that George Shearing and Mel Torme are playing down at the Fairmont Hotel. How'd you like to have a night out on the town with your dad? And she said, Dad, I just love that. And so we looked around and couldn't find a sitter, and she said, Dad, let me call the brother. Let me call Tom down in Houston, and maybe he'll fly up and babysit while we go out on the town. And I said, boy, I'm going to step back and watch this one now, you know. Sure enough, she called Tom, and Tom said, I'd be happy to. And he flew up and babysat, and Roxy and I got all gussied up, and we went down to the Fairmont Hotel. And I remember we walked in, and the maitre d' sat us at a nice table, and the music began to play, and I said to Roxy, hey, would you like to dance? And she said, that'd be terrific. And, you know, as I'm kind of holding this girl, all of a sudden I heard, you're just the greatest dad in all the world. I just don't know anybody as wonderful as you. And, you know, I had worked and waited a lifetime to have her say that to me. You know, I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous to be a good father or to be a good husband or to be a good anything. God, I came to get the pain out. And you gave me a set of principles that overpowered my personality that made me a functioning human being to my family and to my friends and to my neighbor. God, don't you know the love that I had for my daughter that night and the program and the fellowship? I just couldn't get over it. Like Sally said this morning, Roxy loves the program, and whenever she can, she meets us and goes to the meetings and so on. The oldest son that got into drugs and had problems with it and was jailed several times did graduate from the University of Iowa and went to Austin, Texas to get his master's. Somehow Chuck just has a difficult time. And we get strange telephone calls like he's in jail on two counts of criminal harassment. And you know, for the longest time, for the first 12 years in the program, every time they would call, the guilt that I had in the inside of me just somehow enabled me to go write checks, send him money, and do all the things that I shouldn't do. You know, the last time he did that, it was going to be $2,000. And I really didn't have $2,000. And I remember I took it and sent it to Austin and sent it to the attorney. And it was just maybe a month later, and they called, and Chuck's in jail again. And it was, I remember the bail was $5,000, and Chuck got on the telephone, and as we began to talk, I can't tell you why I did it or how I did it. I just said, Chuck, I just don't want to play anymore. I don't care. I care, but I don't care. I don't know how you got in, but you're going to have to get out on your own. And I remember I put the phone down, and God, my heart had never been so heavy. I just, my emotions just froze, and I couldn't think, and I couldn't put the program into practice. And I called Sally's sponsor. I called an Al-Anon in Norman, and I said, God, Vinoy, I've just said no to Chuck for the first time, and my heart is breaking. And she said, of course it is, Albert, but you're going to have to work the steps. I said, damn it, I know about the steps, Vinoy. And she said, yeah, but you're not working them. I said, well, help me. And she said, well, admit that you're powerless over your son, and he makes your life unmanageable. And I said, God, that's right. I am powerless over Chuck. He makes my life unmanageable. And you're going to come to believe that a power greater than yourself is going to restore him to sanity. Yeah, that's right. You know, a power greater than myself is going to restore him to sanity. And you're going to make a decision to turn his will and his life over to the care of God as you understand him. Yeah, I'm going to do that. And then she said, I want you to take a pencil and write down as fast as you can the first four things that come into your mind that make you feel guilty about your son. God, you know, I just took that pencil. I didn't even hesitate. I just wrote down there, made him do things that he didn't want to do when he was small. Because, man, I wanted him to be a competitor. And if the sun was shining, he was playing football, basketball, baseball, whatever it was, I had my foot in the middle of his back. And by God, you will get out there, and I'm doing you a favor. You know how many times I took him and held him up against the wall and just rattled his eyeballs and started to scream, by God, if you just get your hair cut, if you just pick up your room, you just get your grades up, if you would just do what I would tell you, you could be just like me. You know how many times he looked out and said, I'll do anything but be like you? God, I just couldn't believe it. I wrote down there, stole money from his savings account, drank up his educational policies. And I just put those down, just 1, 2, 3, 4, and it was okay. And I want to tell you, an Al-Anon took the pieces of a broken heart that morning and put them back together for an alcoholic. No, my wife's not an Al-Anon because she's married to a drunk. Not an Al-Anon because she's married to an alcoholic. Hey, she is an Al-Anon because she goes to Al-Anon and she's active in Al-Anon and she takes the principles of Al-Anon and brings them into our home. The middle son that Sally talked a little bit about this morning, we've got a couple of business things going together, and every once in a while he just calls me and says, hey, Papa, love you. We're going fishing in a couple weeks because he wants to be with Sally and I. And the young son who used to keep the loaded shotgun for me, who is in New York now wanting to be an actor, a little over a year ago said to me, hey, Dad, can we play some golf? And I said, sure. And afterwards he said, Dad, I need to talk to you a little bit. And I said, okay. And over lunch he said to me, you know, Dad, sometimes I find myself drinking with people that I don't want to be with. Did that ever happen to you? I said, yeah. And he said, sometimes I find myself in places that I don't want to be. Did that ever happen to you? And I said, sure. He said, Dad, sometimes I start out the evening with $200-$300. In the morning, I got 20 or 30, and I don't know where the money went. Did that ever happen to you? I said, sure. He said, what do you think? I said, about what? I said, do you want me to think you have a drinking problem? I said, I'll tell you what I'll do for you. I will do for you what your mom's dad did for me. I'm going to give you the names of two people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to give you their home phone and their business phone. And if the pain in your life gets so bad, you go to them because they've got a way out. I'm your father, and I would kill you. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says working with others, I can't seem to work with my own children. I can't look at them without a certain amount of expectations. I can't get the acceptance without expectations. And what I've come to find out in love in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, you save my kids, and I'll save yours. You know, there's a marvelous story about a little kid named Teddy. He wasn't retarded, he was just slow. And he was the brunt of a lot of laughter and jokes at the kids at the other schools. And one day the teacher said to all the children in the class, I'm going to give you an assignment. I'm going to give each of you a little cart and a little container. I want you to go home, get something that was created by God that was beautiful, bring it back in the morning, and we'll have a little show and tell. And the following morning, the children all brought their containers and their compartments back to school, and she began to call on them one at a time, said, "Jane, would you bring yours up?" And she brought it up, and they opened it up, and on the inside was a rose, and the teacher said, "Only God could have created something that beautiful." And she called on Herman, and Herman brought his up, and they opened it up, and on the inside was a butterfly, and she said to him, "Only God could have created something that beautiful." And then she called on Teddy, and Teddy brought his up, and they opened it up, and it was empty, and everybody began to laugh, and the teacher said to Teddy, "Teddy, I don't understand. The assignment was you were to bring something that was created by God that's beautiful." And Teddy said, "The most beautiful thing that I know of was the resurrection, and that came from an empty tomb." Sometimes I think God reduces us to nothing before he uses us. I think there's a little piece of white velvet on the inside of each one of us that even God doesn't permit us to soil. I think there comes a time when he says, "God, I've got to get Albert out of the race. He isn't doing good." You know, thank God for that. It's nice to have a love affair going with you, lady, after 38 years. I had to come to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous to find out that love is not looking at each other. It's looking in the same direction. You got to give each other the dignity to be a person. You know, chronologically, Sally and I still have a lot of years. I mean, we've spent a lot of years together. But we're still learning how to touch and how to feel and how to be vulnerable and how not to be afraid of each other. Sometimes I'll be vulnerable to you and not to her. And I've had to learn that as far and as deep as I let her look in, that's as far and as deep as I can look out. For the new people in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you were to say to me, "Albert, take a piece of paper and write down all the things that you've lost because you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous," I couldn't scratch the paper. If you were to say to me, "Albert, write down all the things you've lost because you've said your name is Albert Myers and you're an alcoholic," I couldn't scratch the paper. If you were to say to me, "Albert, would you please write down all the things that you lost before you got to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous," I would be here for a long, long time. John being here reminds me that I am part of what I think is the miracle of the century. I think ours, as President Reagan's letter said at the International Convention, ours is the heritage of healing that literally has changed the face of the earth. I checked with John just before I came up here. I think we're over 62,000 registered groups in 114 countries, selling well over 3,000 big books a day. You know, we truly are a family. I can't tell you how grateful I am to be at your conference, but I will tell you this. If Sally and the four children could come up here and be where I'm standing and look out and see what I'm seeing, they would say to you what I'm about to say. We are in deep gratitude for the fact that you have given us our life back. We're privileged to be in your presence, and I love you all so very, very much. Thank you for having me.